Today, Mr. Bertrand Comparé, the well-known attorney and Bible scholar, will discuss the manner in which the term "that's controversial" is being used to prevent the discussion of vital issues. This is an old problem which all of us have encountered in our daily lives. The old cliche, "let's not discuss religion or politics," is a good example. Let's not talk about anything important, and no one will be upset. Your Heritage is in business to be controversial, not as an end in itself, but as a means of pointing out the errors in our thinking which are the result of indoctrination by a world order bent upon the destruction of Christian civilization. If we can cause someone to realize that he has been taught to believe a lie, that person may become suspicious of some of the other concepts he has accepted and is on the way to finding truth for himself. We don't claim that Your Heritage has all the truth, nor that everything we say on this program is true. While we try not to mislead you, we are constantly reviewing the content of the program. And when new revelation indicates that we have been in error, we pray to God for the humility to correct the record and make amends to our listening audience. This is very important to us because we don't want to follow the pattern which has made organized religion the greatest enemy which our Christian civilization faces. Not that organized religion doesn't include within its ranks many dedicated ministers and priests and millions of sincere believers, but because the church system has built such a wall of denominational doctrine that it has become almost impervious to the new truths which are being revealed in these last days. Men don't like to admit error, and the denominational bureaucracy is no exception. Many church doctrines are so palpably false that they would be laughed out of any self-respecting court who would judge such doctrines on the basis of readily available scriptural, historical, and scientific evidence. However, these doctrines can't be laughed off if one is convinced that except for the promised intervention of Almighty God, these very doctrines would spell genocide for the white race and the end of Christian civilization. One of the most devastating teachings of the church world is that the historic Adam was the first man on the earth beginning about 4000 B.C. and the father of the human race, and that about 1656 years later, the whole world was destroyed by the flood, and that Noah and his three sons and their wives alone survived to become in turn the ancestors of all mankind. Despite the scientific discovery of man on earth many thousands of years before Adam, the church world attempted to maintain its dogmatic position in the teeth of incontrovertible evidence, thereby weakening the faith of millions of people in the authenticity of the Bible and opening the way to the theory of evolution. When examined carefully, the Bible does not teach that Adam was the first man, but instead was the first of a newly created white race. The Hebrew word translated Adam literally means ruddy, showing blood in the face, rosy. And since Adam's mate was formed out of Adam, she had to have the same physical characteristics. If the laws of genetic supply, how could the Adam family have produced offspring of widely differing mental and physical characteristics, including elemental color differences? And the same question can be asked with respect to Noah and his family. Besides, there is ample evidence that the flood was not worldwide, but confined to a relatively small area. No, friends, the Bible never conflicts with true science, but will always corroborate it. Church dogma was and still is in error. When we couple the knowledge that the various races had separate origins with the basic biblical law, each after its kind, seed having life in itself, we discover the reason for the biblical writer's insistence upon separation of the races and the reason for the many carefully compiled genealogies recorded in the scriptures. You are invited to write for the full-length articles entitled "Adam Was Not the First Man," "Noah's Flood Was Not Worldwide," and "God Commands Racial Segregation." Our mailing address will be given at the end of the program. Now let us join Mr. Comparé as he discusses the censorship imposed upon us by the term "that's controversial." Mr. Comparé.
Never before in the history of our race has such a spirit of timidity, of abject fear of offending anyone, taken hold of almost everybody. Go where you will, into the homes, the offices, the public dinners, public forums, you will still find this idea that certain subjects are taboo. They cannot be mentioned because they are controversial. Oddly enough, only vitally important matters are controversial. Why are you forbidden to freely speak your views on the important subjects of social, economic, political, and religious life of today? Well, you really aren't forbidden to, unless you happen to be on the side of good Americanism, of conservatism, of Christianity. You constantly find that those who hate your God are free to speak their minds at all times, to denounce your religion, even to demand that the forces of law be turned against it, to outlaw it in the schools and all public places. If you say a word in protest, you are at once denounced as a religious bigot and reminded that there is freedom of religion and freedom of atheism, that is, for everyone except you. Those who hate everything that has made our nation great, who hate all that has brought us the highest standard of living the world has ever known, and who want to replace it with that front porch of communism, socialism, these have almost monopolized our schools, and they have completely taken over the Republican and Democratic branches of our one political party. They can, and they do, speak against our way of life on every occasion. Oppose them with a word, and you are at once reminded of their sacred right of free speech. But you have no such right, for you are called a reactionary for opposing them. Those who hate our free nation, to which most of them very recently came as refugees, and who want to destroy its freedom by making it a conquered province of the United Nations, ruled by the cannibals of the Congo, because the jungle savage nations of Africa alone outvote us 25-1, they are free to undermine and attack our nation at all times and in every way. And if you speak in opposition to this, you are called fascist and hate monger. It has actually reached the point where anyone who upholds the political and social views of such great Americans as George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, or Herbert Hoover is described by most of our newspaper columnists and radio and TV commentators as being extreme right-wing, often coupled with an insinuation of fascist or Nazi sympathies. Why is it that their always offensive attacks upon all American and Christian principles are sacrosanct, while all your defense of the principles of our free nation, our way of life, our religion, has suddenly become controversial and hence to be avoided? It is because the truth has always been controversial. And what makes it controversial? Only the fact that the evil always attack it, and they also attack the man who speaks the truth. Christianity is controversial because all the satanic wickedness in 2,000 years has been hurled against it. The most controversial figure in all history is the one who is the very personification of truth, Jesus Christ. But he never fled from controversy, neither kept silent to avoid offending the wicked. To the contrary, he pressed the attack against evil. Today, those who are not able to silence truth completely try then to cut it down to the point where it's no longer effective by telling us that we must speak only of issues, we must not mention personalities. But you can't fight evil this way, because there is no evil in the abstract. It exists only in the evil deeds of evil persons. What good can it do to sermonize against wickedness in the abstract, to merely shadow box with the dictionary? There can't be any burglary without a burglar, no treason without a traitor. Point the searchlight of truth at the traitors, and you can eliminate them, and the treason then must stop. But if you merely debate the silly question whether treason is one of the inherent rights of all liberals, the traitors will work on without hindrance. These truths Jesus Christ knew and demonstrated. The beginning of his ministry was when he found the temple filled with the corruption of the money changers. Did he preach abstract sermons on the desirability of honesty and of reverence for the house of God, but of course without mentioning the dishonest or the irreverent? No, indeed. He made a whip of ropes and he flogged those crooks out of the temple. He found the temple and all the organized religion of the day in the hands of the Pharisees, men of much outward piety but spiritual frauds. Did he content himself with preaching on religion in the abstract without giving offense to the Pharisees? Oh, no. The Bible records 9 times he denounced them as hypocrites, 6 times as blind and fools. Once he identified them as serpents, a race of vipers, and he told them that even the tax collectors and the harlots would enter the kingdom of God before they could. He knew that false ideas cannot arise or exist without someone to teach the falsehoods, so he exposed them. Of course, this brought upon him the bitterest hatred ever directed against any person in all history, hatred which is as strong today as it was on the day of the crucifixion. We Christians are also hated for our religion, but Christianity grew great and strong despite its enemies, and it produced its greatest leaders under the stress of persecution. It was always greatest when it was most controversial. Jesus Christ foresaw this, and in the 10th chapter of Matthew, he told us, "Whosoever, therefore, shall confess me before men, him will I also confess before my Father which is in heaven. But whosoever shall deny me before men, him will I also deny before my Father which is in heaven. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. You can't proclaim truth without opposition. Water it down until evil no longer attacks you, and you have no truth left. The only thing which can peacefully coexist with evil is some other evil. Then what should we do? Good can only be controversial if the wicked attack it. So turn the tables on them. Make their attacks on Americanism and Christianity controversial. Get them on the run. Learn the weak points of their principles and attack. Many of us are doing this very successfully. Defend your own views when needed, of course, but never limit yourself to the defensive. Carry the war to the enemy. Their propaganda has had the field almost entirely to itself, and it has brainwashed millions of people. Refute the lies they have foisted upon us. Never let such propaganda be spoken in your presence without reply. Of course, you must know what you're talking about so you won't lose the argument. Make lists of the failures of socialism and keep one of them always with you for reference when the subject comes up. Learn the details of the various death traps to liberty and civilization which are hidden in the United Nations and its various so-called conventions, and never lose an opportunity to point them out. Make it so controversial for any anti-American, anti-Christian to spout his attacks that those who fear controversy will no longer give the enemy free rein to start it. Don't be afraid of controversy. The enemies of all truth and all good will always attack every time they can. You have just two choices: either cowardly surrender while evil triumphs, or else vigorous counterattacks to drive the wicked out of all places of advantage. Jesus Christ warned you that Christianity must fight to survive. The victories of past generations must not be lost today. Onward, Christian soldiers. If the wicked want to make good controversial, let it be at their own peril. We should be proud of what our God and our ancestors have done for us. Speak up. Teach the principles of our religion and our civilization to your poor, brainwashed children who are now being taught socialism and atheism in many high schools and most colleges. We didn't receive our fine heritage from cowards, neither can cowards preserve it. You should be the one taking the initiative, making the enemy retreat. And if that's controversial, make the most of it. This is Bertrand L. Comperé, and there are some more things about which I want to talk to you. Things found in that little understood book, the Bible. The first thing I want to talk to you about is the fact that Adam was not the first man. Many people have become agnostics because of the supposed conflict between the Bible and science. In truth, there's no conflict at all between a correct translation of the Bible and really proven science, not just unproved theories. One of these supposed conflicts is between the fact that science knows that human beings have lived on the earth far longer than the few thousand years covered by the Bible, and the common belief that the Bible says that Adam was the first man. But the truth is that the Bible nowhere says that Adam was the first man. Yes, I know that most of the preachers say that, but the Bible doesn't. It merely says that Adam was the first white man, our ancestor. Let's look at the record. The many mistranslations in the King James Version obscure much of the truth. For example, Genesis 1, verses 1 and 2. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. In the Hebrew it says, now the earth had become chaotic and empty. For example, see Rotherham's emphasized Bible. That is, some early catastrophe had wrecked the earth, which was not without form and void up until that time. This was a judgment of God on earlier civilizations for their wickedness. Jeremiah 4, verses 23 to 27 gives a vision of it. I beheld the earth, and lo, it was without form and void, and the heavens, and they had no light. I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved lightly. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the wilderness were fled. I beheld, and lo, the fruitful place was a wilderness, and all the cities thereof were broken down at the presence of the Lord and by his fierce anger. For thus hath the Lord said, the whole land shall be desolate, yet will I not make a full end. Therefore, we do find buried ruins of cities older than Adam, and skeletons which can be dated by the carbon-14 process as many thousands of years older. But the Bible itself tells us about this. Next, the Bible tells of the creation of man, in the plural, in Genesis 1, verses 26 to 28, saying, male and female created he them. And God told these people, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth. Now, plenish is an obsolete English word meaning to fill, and you cannot replenish what was never plenished or filled before. In the next chapter, Genesis 2, we find the Adam, in the singular, created. The Hebrew word Adam, rendered Adam in English, is from a root word meaning of a ruddy complexion, showing blood in the face. Don't you remember all those nice red-cheeked Negroes you've seen? No, neither do I. This word obviously is not applicable to the dark races, and we also know from scientific evidence that the dark races are much older than the white race. Bible scholars know that Genesis 3, verse 20, and Adam called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living, is a much later interpolation, which was not in the earlier manuscripts. See Moffat's translation, for example. The fourth chapter of Genesis records the birth of Cain and Abel. In the Hebrew, the wording suggests that they were twins. No other child of Eve is mentioned until the birth of Seth, when Adam was 130 years old, certainly long after the birth of Cain and Abel, which most scholars say was over 100 years earlier. Yet when Cain killed Abel and in punishment was driven out of the land, Cain complained to God that anyone that finds me shall slay me. That's Genesis chapter 4, verse 14. And upon being sent away, Cain found many other people, for Genesis 4, verse 17 records that Cain not only married a wife, but there were enough people around to build a city. These were the pre-Adamite races mentioned in the latter part of Genesis 1. The Garden of Eden was not a plantation of ordinary trees and shrubs. God did nothing so foolish as to make a special creation just to have a man to wield shovel and pruning shears, when he already had millions of pre-Adamite peoples available for that sort of work. We are told that the Garden of Eden contained the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or as some translations say, the tree of the experience of good and evil. Now, no wooden tree of the forest has any knowledge or experience of either good or evil. But Ezekiel 31 says, behold, the Assyrian was a cedar in Lebanon, with fair branches and a shadowing bough, and of a high stature. Therefore his height was exalted above all the trees of the field, and his boughs were multiplied, and his branches became long. All the fowls of heaven made their nests in his boughs, and under his branches did all the beasts of the field bring forth their young, and under his shadow dwelt all great nations. The cedars in the garden of God could not hide him. The fir trees were not like his boughs, and the chestnut trees were not like his branches, nor any tree in the garden of God was like unto him in his beauty. I have made him fair by the multitude of his branches, so that all the trees of Eden that were in the garden of God envied him. Obviously, the trees in the garden of God in Eden were family trees of races and nations who admired and envied the early Assyrian Empire, because ordinary wooden trees certainly couldn't envy anybody. These racial family trees made up the garden that Adam was to cultivate. That is, Satan had been what we might call superintendent or governor of this planet, to rule it in obedience to God's will, until he forfeited that position by rebellion against God. Adam was sent to take his place. It was Adam's job to rule the various nations and races of the earth as God's representative here, educating them in God's laws and enforcing obedience to those laws. These other races and nations had been here long before Adam. Therefore, the Bible makes it unmistakably clear that not all people are descended from Adam and Eve, for there were other races on earth, already old, already numerous, when Adam was created. And among these other races, there are several who are simply pre-Adamic, and one at least, Jewish, which is satanic. If you will read the third chapter of Genesis, you will notice that immediately after the fall of Adam, when God required them to answer what they had done, God condemned Satan. The word mistranslated serpent in your King James Version is the Hebrew word nokash, which literally means enchanter or magician. And, no doubt, Satan, still possessing angelic powers, was able to be an enchanter or magician. It is certain that the one who seduced Eve was no mere scaly snake wriggling along the ground. Yes, I said seduced Eve, for that is what she admitted in the original Hebrew. Cain was the son of that seduction. The Bible uses the word begat with monotonous regularity, but the first time the Bible ever says that Adam ever begat anyone is Genesis 5, verse 3, where it says, "And Adam lived 130 years, and begat a son in his own likeness, after his image, and called his name Seth." But to get back to Genesis 3, verse 15, God said to Satan, "I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed." The same Hebrew word for seed is used in both cases. Satan was to have just as literal seed or descendants as Eve. God's own word being pledged to this, we must expect to find it actually happening. And we do. Jesus Christ himself tells us of it. In Matthew 13, verses 38 and 39, explaining the parable of the tares among the wheat, Jesus says, "The field is the world. The good seed are the children of the kingdom. But the tares are the children of the wicked one. The enemy that sowed them is the devil." Again in John 6, verses 70 and 71, Jesus had been talking with his 12 disciples, and we read, "Jesus answered them, 'Have not I chosen you 12? And one of you is a devil.' He spake of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, for he it was that should betray him, being one of the 12." And again, you should read carefully the 8th chapter of the Gospel of John, beginning with verse 31. In this chapter, Jesus told these Jews who hated him, "Ye are of your father the devil, and the lusts of your father ye will do." Now, Jesus was not being vulgarly abusive in either of these cases, for he never resorted to name-calling or abuse. He did call some of them hypocrites, which they truly were, so his statement was precisely accurate. He did call some of them serpents, children of vipers, which again was accurate. Long before this, they had adopted the serpent as a symbol of Satan. That is why their tradition had given the word nokash the secondary meaning of serpent, when it really means enchanter. Jesus therefore was telling them that they were of their father the devil, or serpent if they preferred that word. In this he was simply stating a biological fact with scientific precision, just as if he had said to a Chinaman, "Your ancestors were Mongolians." Whenever someone tells you that the Bible is in conflict with what modern science has proved true, don't you believe it. The things that most preachers teach are in conflict with scientific truth, as we all know. But these preachers are equally in conflict with the Bible. Go back to the Bible, not to any man-made doctrines, and double-check your Bible for accuracy of translation. You will find that what the Bible really says in its original languages is accurate with a precision which our scientists have not yet achieved. This is Bertrand L. Comperay, and I have a few things in my mind about which I'd like to talk to you. The first of these is the fact that contrary to what is taught in most churches, Noah's flood was not worldwide. Among the many mistaken and unscriptural notions commonly taught in nearly all churches is the idea that the flood mentioned in the Bible covered all the earth and drowned everybody on earth excepting only Noah and his family, who escaped death by being in the ark. So many churches have firmly insisted that the Bible says this, when there is ample proof that the flood was not worldwide, that they have destroyed the faith of multitudes of people in the Bible, made atheists or agnostics out of hundreds of thousands of people who might have become Christians if they had only been taught the truth about the Bible. Part of this mistaken idea about the flood is due to the many mistranslations found in the commonly used King James Version of the Bible. But also, part of it appears plainly to be false if you merely carefully read even the King James Version. Let's have a look at this. In Genesis chapter 6, we read that God found the people so corrupt that he regretted that he had ever created them, and so he decided to wipe them out by a flood. And he warned righteous Noah of the coming flood, and told Noah to build a great boat or ark in which he and his family might find safety, and where they might preserve a few of each kind of the animals. In chapter 7, it tells how Noah received the final warning that the time was now at hand, and that he should move into the ark. Then it says, according to the King James Version, "And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. And the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And the waters prevailed, and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went upon the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast, and of every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth, and every man. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. And God remembered Noah and every living thing, and all the cattle that was with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters assuaged. And the waters returned from off the earth continually. And after the end of the 150 days, the waters were abated. And the ark rested in the 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the 1st day of the month, were the tops of the mountains seen." Now, first let's see what the translators have done to what Moses originally wrote. You remember that the King James Version says that the rain was upon the earth, and the waters increased greatly upon the earth, and that all flesh died that moved upon the earth. But are they right in translating this, the earth? Definitely not. Remember that in Genesis 4:14, when God has driven Cain away in punishment for his murder of Abel, the King James Version quotes Cain as saying, "Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth." So what did Cain do? Climb into his rocket ship and take off for outer space? Of course not. He was not driven from the face of the earth, and he never said so. Only the translators said so. The word Cain used was Adamah, meaning the ground. God had told him that his farming would no longer be successful. So Cain says, "Thou hast driven me off of the ground." And you have probably noticed that Cain's descendants today are not farmers. They run pawn shops and other money-lending institutions. When we come to the 7th chapter of Genesis, where it is talking about the flood, wherever it says that the flood covered the earth, the Hebrew word used in the original writing by Moses was Eretz, meaning the land. The flood did cover that particular land where it occurred. That is, it was a local flood which covered one particular region or land, but not the whole earth. Again, notice that it specifies that 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. In ancient times, two different lengths of the cubit were in use. The Hebrew sacred cubit of 25 inches and the common cubit of 20 5/8 inches. Therefore, the waters rose above the tops of the mountains of which it is speaking by either 25 feet 9 inches or 31 feet 3 inches, according to which cubit you use. If this meant that all the mountains on earth were covered, the waters would have to cover Mount Everest, which is nearly 6 miles high. Therefore, all the earth would be covered by water 6 miles deep. In that case, where could it have run off to when the flood subsided? No, I don't mean that the Bible was that badly mistaken. Only the translators made this mistake, because they took a Hebrew word, Eretz, which means that land, and mistranslated it to mean the whole world. A little later, we shall look over the evidence which proves where that land was. But if the whole earth was covered by 6 miles of water, then all the nations must have been completely exterminated. Yet Babylonian, Egyptian, and Chinese history runs right through this period without a break. The Bible gives the date of Noah's flood as commencing in 2345 B.C. and ending in 2344 B.C. In Lower Sumer, later called Chaldea, and which occupied the same plains of Shinar to which Noah's family journeyed after the flood, the city of Ur of the Chaldees was the leading city from about 2400 B.C. until about 2285 B.C., and its history is not broken by any flood in this period. Farther to the north, Babylon was rising to power from about 2400 B.C. on, and reached a great height of civilization under the famous King Hammurabi, who lived at the same time as the Hebrew patriarch Abraham, about 2250 B.C. And again, there is no break in this history due to a flood. In Egypt, the 11th dynasty began to reign about 2375 B.C. over a great and powerful nation. The 11th dynasty ruled Egypt to about 2212 B.C., and were followed by the 12th dynasty, which ruled to about 2000 B.C. There was no break in the 11th dynasty at the time of Noah's flood, 2345 B.C., and the nation continued to be large and powerful throughout this period. Reasonably accurate history of China begins nearly 3000 B.C. The Shu King, the historic record of China, shows that King Yao came to the throne in 2356 B.C., 11 years before the start of Noah's flood, and that he ruled China for many years after the flood. During the reign of King Yao, the Shu King reports that the Huang Ho River, which drains mountains and a great basin in Xinjiang province, had excessive floods for three generations. Here again, there was no break in history. The Chinese nation was not wiped out, but its own records show that it continued in existence right through the period of Noah's flood. Therefore, the Bible is correct in stating that the flood covered only Eretz, that land, and that the translators are wrong when they change the meaning of what Moses really wrote in the 7th chapter of Genesis and say that the flood covered all the earth. This leaves us ready to inquire where the flood did occur. For this, we will have to start with Adam and Eve and trace where they and their descendants went. They started out in the Garden of Eden. Genesis 2, verses 10 to 14 tells us that a river went out of Eden, and this river divided into four streams. It names these four rivers, Pison and Gihon, neither of which can be identified among the rivers existing today, and Hiddekel, which is the ancient name of the Tigris River, and Frath, the ancient name of the river Euphrates. The Tigris and Euphrates rise in what is today extreme southeastern Turkey, a little north of modern Iraq. Making some allowance for the fact that many rivers have changed their courses considerably in the course of several thousand years, this still places the Garden of Eden at the northern end of ancient Akkad. When Adam and Eve were driven out of the Garden of Eden, Genesis 3, verse 24 tells us that God placed cherubim with a flaming sword at the east side of the Garden of Eden to keep Adam and Eve from returning and having access to the Tree of Life. If this guard was to accomplish anything, it must have been placed between Adam and the Garden of Eden. So we see that Adam and Eve were driven out to the eastward. From Eden, Adam's course would naturally have led him across northern Iran around the southern end of the Caspian Sea into what was formerly called Chinese Turkestan and today is known as Xinjiang Province in the extreme west of China. In the southern part of Xinjiang, there is a great basin rimmed by high mountains on all sides, but with an outlet on the eastern end of it, through the mountains where the headwaters of the Huanghe, the Yellow River, rises. This basin is today nearly all desert, but it bears the evidence of a fertile and heavily inhabited past. Explorers have found ruins of ancient cities uncovered by the drifting sands of the desert. Also, the known geological structure shows that in ancient times, at least, beneath this desert lay an enormous underground natural reservoir, great caverns filled with water. The same geological structure which furnishes artesian water in many parts of the world today. These underground reservoirs were covered by waterproof layers of rock, which kept the waters beneath from overflowing out on the land surface above them. In this mountain-rimmed basin, which was then a fertile, well-populated land, Adam and Eve, or at least their descendants of a few generations later, settled. You who listen to our program already know that Adam was not the first man. He was only the first man in the present white race. Adam and Eve found this land to which they had come already populated by an Asiatic people, among whom they had to live. Through the following generations, the inevitable happened. Wherever there is integration, then intermarriage and mongrelization of the races follows. But if God had no purposes in mind which could not be properly served by the Asiatic and Negro races, there would have been no reason for him to create Adam. Neither could the purposes which Adam and his descendants were intended to serve be fulfilled by a mongrelized race. The consequences of this mongrelization are described in Genesis 6, verse 5. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Again, we find that the word there mistranslated earth is the Hebrew word eretz, which means only the land, that particular land. And there is reason for using that Hebrew word, for this was the place where integration and mongrelization had taken place, with its degenerative effect as compared to the qualities possessed by each race separately. We find confirmation of this in the reason why God spared Noah. In Genesis 6, verse 9, your King James Version of the Bible tells you that Noah was perfect in his generations, a meaningless phrase. When anything in the King James Version of the Bible fails to make good sense, it is a sign that you should go behind the mistranslation and see what the words were in the original Hebrew or Greek. The word here translated generations was the Hebrew word teledos, which means ancestry. That is, Noah was perfect in his ancestry, a thoroughbred, not a mongrel. Noah and his family were the last remaining pure-blooded Adamites in the world. Therefore, God needed to save them to carry out the purposes he had planned for the Adamic people. The mongrelized people among whom Noah and his family lived must be removed, else they would be a trap which would eventually lead to the complete end of the pure-blooded Adamites. Have we any other evidence to support our view that this was the region where Adam and Eve and their descendants settled? Yes. Remember that Adam and Eve were driven out of Eden to the eastward. Later, when Cain murdered Abel, and as a punishment was banished from the land where Adam and Eve lived, Genesis 4, verse 16 tells us that Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. The Hebrew word Nod means wandering. That is, in the upper Tigris and Euphrates valleys at the north of Eden, these rivers were running swiftly downhill from their mountain sources. Therefore, they cut themselves deep channels in the ground. And even today, we can find the traces of the ancient diversion dams built by the ancients to raise the water level up close to the surface of the ground so they would not have to pump it so high to get it into their irrigation canals. But further to the south, in the lower Tigris and Euphrates valleys, where the slope was no longer steep, The accumulation of silt picked up of the rivers where they ran swiftly was now settling to the bottom of the riverbeds, constantly raising the level, so that every high water season, the rivers overflowed their banks and flooded the valleys, exactly the same as we have had in our own Mississippi Valley.